It's Tuesday, February 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Turkey's military becomes increasingly active along its border with Syria. President Obama opens the ASEAN summit in California.
Women are talking about having sleepless nights, not being able to concentrate at work because they keep thinking about the rape.
The scars of post-election turmoil in Kenya. Also ahead, country music fights cancer. And much more. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Turkey is conducting a third consecutive day of cross-border airstrikes on Kurdish fighters in northern Syria and warning of a harsh response if Kurdish-led forces do not retreat from their positions near the border. The Kurdish YPG militia has taken over large amounts of territory from Islamist rebels along Syria's border with Turkey, that coming in recent days, by exploiting a Russian-backed Syrian government offensive against the rebels. The YPG advance has alarmed Turkey. It accuses the group of having links to the PKK, a Kurdish rebel group viewed as a terrorist group by Ankara, and worries the Kurds may be trying to set up a separate region along the border. Diplomats in New York said Monday that Russia has asked the UN Security Council to hold discussions on Turkish military actions in Syria and Iraq. Russia, though, has not commented. The fighting underscores the complicated nature of the conflict in Syria, where fighting has killed hundreds of thousands of people and created millions of refugees over the past 4.5 years. Regional analyst Peter Bechtold of Portland State University tells VOA's Victor Beatty the animosity between the Turks and Kurds goes back nearly 100 years.
From a Turkish point of view, and I think that much of the world looks at it this way, the borders that were drawn after World War I have not served people very well. The Turkish-Syrian border has been very, very controversial on both sides. The border should have been drawn much deeper into Iraq, especially, and in particular into Mosul, in order to prevent a Kurdish separatist movement. Because if there is a Kurdish separatist movement, it will take a quarter of Turkey in the southeastern region. And so whenever there's a Kurdish organization that becomes armed, they're afraid, here they come. Because this struggle has been going on since the 1920s. It may not have been on Americans' radar screens, but it's been going on ever since.
On Friday, the international powers, part of this International Syria Study Group, called for a cessation of hostilities within a week. Is that possible?
Well, it is possible, and I think that's why you have the intensive fighting. When you declare a deadline, not immediately, but some days down the road, the fighting parties go all out in order to get maximum leverage.
The White House said Sunday that President Obama spoke by phone with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, urging Moscow to end the strikes. Quote, he emphasized the importance now of Russia playing a constructive role by ceasing its air campaign against moderate opposition forces in Syria. Will Russia end its hostilities?
From the Russian point of view, they are doing what they were called upon to do, which is to defend the government against everybody who's fighting the government. And this is where the problem is, because the U.S. number one objective is to degrade and eventually defeat the Islamic State. But the number two objective is also the number one objective of Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and that is to get rid of President Assad. And so there's a conflict there. And the Russian number one objective is still to maintain their alliance with the government in Syria, but they have been persuaded to also have as a high priority the issue of the Islamic State, because many of the fighters in the Islamic State come from southern Russia.
Peter Bechtold, a retired State Department official, says while Damascus, with Russian and Iranian help, hopes to extend its authority once again over all of Syria, and it hopes to at least retake the territory that extends north of the capital to Aleppo, including two port cities. President Obama has welcomed the leaders of 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in California at the resort of Sunnylands. The two-day summit of U.S. and ASEAN leaders is the first of its kind to be hosted by the United States. ASEAN comprises the nations of Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, Brunei, Vietnam, Laos, Myanmar, and Cambodia. The summit is being watched closely on social media and by our own G. Abby Lee, who follows the trends for International Edition. She joins me right here in the studio for the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, what are some of the accounts that we can follow to keep us posted?
The official ASEAN account at ASEAN is a good one, but I want to recommend the U.S. mission to ASEAN, too. The Jakarta-based account can be found at U.S. mission 2 in Arabic number, ASEAN. The U.S. mission retweets a lot from the U.S. ambassador to ASEAN, Nina Hachigian. She has a very personable and casual approach to her tweets, one of them reading, "I heart ASEAN."
So, what are some of the official reactions coming out of Washington?
Jim, many U.S. government accounts are tweeting about the summit, obviously, using the hashtag USASEAN2016. The State Department tweeted, "U.S. is taking its relationship with ASEAN to a new level. Learn more about our strategic partnership." So you can tell from these tweets that Washington is taking its quote-unquote pivot to Asia quite seriously.
Absolutely. It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any ASEAN dignitaries who are tweeting about the event?
Some are, especially from those former English-speaking colonies. So here I have tweets from Malaysia and the Philippines. The former was a British colony and the latter American. Anwar Ibrahim is Malaysia's former deputy PM and, as you know, definitely a controversial figure. But his tweet regarding the summit was just factual and nothing opinionated. He's actually serving a 5-year prison term, so I'm not quite sure how he's tweeting, but his handle is at Anwar Ibrahim and describes himself as a prisoner of conscience. Another tweet is from the Filipino president, Noynoy Aquino, at Noynoy Aquino. Most of his tweets are in Tagalog, but there are a couple in English from today. Now, before I go, I want to say we love to hear from our listeners what they're expecting from the summit. So if you're listening, please make sure to follow us on Twitter and share your thoughts. That's all for me today. Jim?
Thanks, G. Our International Edition Twitter stream is at VOA underscore IE. You can follow both of us there and individually, too. G's account is at G. Abby Lee. I'm at VOA Stevenson. VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas is with the president in Sunnylands, California. That, of course, the location of the ASEAN summit. She's taking a short pause to join us following President Barack Obama's opening remarks just a short time ago.
The headline, I think, was a message to all 10 ASEAN leaders, and that is that together they can advance a regional order where all nations play by the same rules. That is critical because you have all these nations and they're so different. And the White House is really pushing to have them coalesce, come together, come up with a common set of principles by which they will all agree to abide and to operate under. And so this, the president said, levels the playing field. Everyone can engage. The economies can interconnect. And that they can move forward.
Several years ago, he coined the phrase a pivot to Asia, which has been a bit maligned over the years because it hasn't been particularly well defined. And I would presume that he's going to be using this ASEAN meeting to help redefine that goal.
Yeah, well, he's calling it the rebalance. He sees this as an area where the U.S. must, for its future prosperity, for its security, and also really for the world, that must engage, must be a part of what's happening there, that it has been underrepresented in the last few decades. So he's, I think, casting it as critical to the U.S. economically in terms of security and its influence.
We talk so much about trade and economic partnerships in the region, especially in light of the recent TPP agreement. But there's so many other aspects, as you mentioned, that he's looking at: human rights, human dignity, and of course, the common threat of terrorism.
He sees many common interests in this area. There are those that they experience they're going through now economically. There's opportunity there. They see this as a region that's really thriving when it comes to innovation and knowledge-based skills. And they're saying that's where we in the U.S. can really be a good partner to you. And, of course, the U.S. can tap into the economy there. People-to-people contact is important, too. Then there are various levels of various political models, though, levels of democracy or not, human rights issues. And so at this point, the U.S. is saying, look, we're not dictating what model any of the ASEAN countries should adopt right now. We're looking for opportunities when there's movement in any of these nations toward democratization, and we will be there to support them. So that is a controversial issue. Some see it as sort of legitimizing governments that are known for terrible human rights abuses and oppression.
And very mindful of looking toward the future as well, he brought up the Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative.
Yes, that's something actually the White House has been touting a lot. They do see that as the future, is a forum for young people to engage in terms of what their aspirations are, but also to speak more openly. And so they see that as moving forward, something that's going to be an investment that will pay off in the long term, that sooner or later these young leaders will rise up and sort of demand their own destiny.
As they say, the future is now, and right now, Mary Alice Salinas is with the president at the ASEAN Summit. Mary Alice, thanks so much for taking some time out and spending it with us.
My pleasure.
This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new Human Rights Watch report released Monday says hundreds of women and girls still bear the physical and mental scars of sexual violence following Kenya's post-election turmoil in 2007 and 2008. The report says the government has not helped them. From Nairobi, we hear more from VOA's Jill Craig.
Human Rights Watch says some 900 women and girls were victims of sexual violence during the post-election period, and many cases likely were unreported. The group says lack of medical attention left many survivors unable to work or pursue an education and stuck in poverty. Jacqueline Mutere alleges a neighbor's friend forcefully entered her house, pretending to seek refuge from the violence.
He started the pushing and shoving. He started making advances at me, and I refused them. They had my small kids in the room, in the house they were sleeping. And I wasn't going to accept his advances. And with brute force, no way. And so he became violent, extremely violent. He slapped me around a few times, actually. He burst my eardrum.
HRW's Agnes Othiombo is senior researcher for women's rights in Africa and interviewed survivors for the report.
Women have a lot of injuries, back injuries, leg injuries, chest injuries, because the rapes were just so brutal. They included, you know, kicking women, slapping them, cutting them with machetes, pulling legs apart.
She says victims also suffered mentally.
Women were talking about having sleepless nights, not being able to concentrate at work because they keep thinking about the rape. And let's not forget that these women were not just raped, they were also affected, just like other victims of the post-election violence, by losing their homes, losing their loved ones, husbands, children in the violence.
Othiombo says many victims were gang raped by anywhere from 4 to at least 10 men, at times in front of family members, including young children, and were stigmatized by their husbands and communities. Some women contracted sexually transmitted diseases, became pregnant, or both. Because abortion is illegal in Kenya, even in rape cases, some women obtained so-called backstreet or back alley abortions that left them with severe internal damage. Those who carried their pregnancies to term faced additional abuse and discrimination, as did their children. When women reported their rapes, they were often told to find their perpetrator and bring him to the police, or were accused of lying for political reasons. The government has acknowledged rapes occurred during that period, but has not offered assistance to the victims. Human Rights Watch is urging the government to use its restorative justice fund of about $9.8 million announced last March to help survivors, especially those urgently needing medical and psychosocial services. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
In many countries, sadly, it's not uncommon for former top politicians to be jailed for crimes committed while in office. But in Israel, Ehud Olmert has become the first former prime minister to end up behind bars. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem as Olmert began a 19-month prison term on Monday.
He was convicted of bribery in a real estate scandal over events that occurred earlier when he was mayor of Jerusalem. In a statement before entering the prison, Olmert continued to claim innocence.
Shani kofer mikol v'chol b'yishumei ha'shochad shiyuchasu li.
I categorically deny that I ever took a bribe, he said. Nevertheless, Olmert was found guilty of accepting about $130,000 in bribes to promote the construction of a luxury apartment complex in Jerusalem. Olmert admitted that he made mistakes, but denied any criminal wrongdoing. He said he accepts the sentence with a heavy heart because no one is above the law. Olmert is the latest of many senior Israeli officials to serve prison time. They include former President Moshe Katsav, who is serving a 7-year term for rape. The scandals have shaken public confidence in the government, leaving Israelis with the feeling that their elected officials are hopelessly corrupt. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Stay with us as coming up, we have news of a charity drive by a very popular singer. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Technology may be advancing rapidly in many fields, but in some areas of science and research, it's lagging behind the times. Many museums here in the United States, and in other countries as well, still do not have their fossil collections easily searchable online. Specimens are often left in drawers and virtually hidden from view. There's a national effort to change all of that. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
It is a scientist's dream to discover something new.
I would say it's new.
Tori Nyberg may have discovered a new species of crab.
It's kind of a treasure hunt when you're trying to find something new.
A treasure hunt is how researchers find specimens stored in many museums. Countless fossils stored in museum drawers like these are considered dark data because there is no easy way to find them.
Now it's a crapshoot. It's just you don't know. It's a matter of just looking through the drawers and spending the time and doing a treasure hunt at this point in time.
With funding from the National Science Foundation, collections managers are trying to bring the hidden specimens to light by digitizing museum collections so anyone with a computer can easily find and access information about a specific one.
I think there's been a bit of a lag for the museum community to catch on to the availability of the technology, but also to realize that there is a need for it.
The Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County is in the process of digitizing some of its fossil collection. The museum's Austin Hindi says data collected on these fossils will give scientists clues about how organisms will respond to climate change based on what happened to them when the Earth warmed and cooled in the past. He says there is an international push to get specimens online.
And that is bound to increase research opportunities, foster collaborations across geographic, political, or even language boundaries. And that's, I think, one of the exciting aspects of what we're doing with the digitization process.
Having specimens available online will also save time and money, says the Smithsonian Institution's Carlos Jaramillo. He is conducting research in Panama and spoke to VOA by Skype.
Well, it really has transformed the way we do research, because otherwise it would be very difficult to access most of the collections that there are worldwide.
The U.S., China, Australia, and European countries are sharing information on the best way of digitizing specimens, so researchers from around the world can have access to specimens that span the globe. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
As scientists work to show you their extensive collections online, you may see this story there. Just stop by our website at voanews.com. Philanthropy has always been an integral part of country music. And when it comes to cancer awareness, Martina McBride has been at front and center. The iconic singer has recently announced an exciting new venture to empower families in their fight against this devastating disease. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to discuss the details.
Nikki, tell us about this new initiative called Band Against Cancer.
Okay, so Band Against Cancer is a partnership with some heavy hitters, with Sarah Cannon, the Global Cancer Institute of Hospital Corporation of America, and the record label Big Label Machine Group, which has an incredible roster of artists, including Taylor Swift, Reba McEntire, Florida Georgia Line, Tim McGraw, Martina McBride, to name a few. So Martina McBride, along with several other high-profile country artists, no word yet as to who it will be, they will hit the road for the Sarah Cannon Tour. Details are still forthcoming, but right now we do know the tour will hit several cities across the U.S. and end in October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Now, not only will these concerts help raise money for charitable organizations, cancer support organizations, but each concert is going to have special on-site activities so that attendees can also find ways to be a more active part of the Band Against Cancer movement, aside from just, you know, paying to go see a concert. And the objective, they say, is to bring together survivors and patients and families and friends and artists and music lovers and cancer experts and advocates in communities across the country in this fight against cancer. And through these various collective efforts, patients will ultimately access high-quality treatment and research options that are close to home where they are.
Mm. Well, will this initiative cover all kinds of cancer?
Well, the initiative initially, we'll focus on those who'll be fighting blood cancer, and then eventually we'll highlight other kinds of cancer as well.
Now, Martina had a huge song that was about fighting cancer.
Yes, yes, which is so appropriate why she's headlining this. The song is called I'm Gonna Love You Through It. It came out in 2011 off of her CD 11, and it's about a 38-year-old woman who is supported by her husband while battling breast cancer. It was nominated for a Grammy that year. It peaked at number 4 on the country singles chart, and it has really been a major anthem in the cancer fighting community. And Martina has participated in all kinds of events to raise awareness about this disease. So, and she says helping families who are facing cancer has always been a cause that is near and dear to her heart.
You can get more information about this initiative at bandagainstcancer.org. You can also hear Martina McBride and other great country artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you're on social media, feel free to connect with Nikki at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA _music on Twitter. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
She dropped the phone and burst into tears. The doctor just confirmed her fears. Her husband held it in and held her tight. Cancer don't discriminate or care if you're just 38, with 3 kids who need you in their lives. He said, I know that you're afraid, and
Been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. We invite you to follow us at @VOA_IE. And while you're there online, check out our Facebook page, VOA Asia. Don't let the name fool you. There's lots of great stuff on there for everybody, no matter where you are in the world. We thank you so much for joining us today and invite you to come back. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington.
From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971. With a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.